to join the other self. He wants to form friendship with him. He wants to merge with him.
He remains in solitude. Hence the personality as such. The self remains in solitary and lonely thing. And of course, gentlemen, I don't have to tell you. You know when people become aware of that?
Of this, in times of crisis. We know as rabbis, for instance, and you probably know that too, if a man should be afflicted by a very, very disease, a fatal disease, and more or less his, so to say, his conscience
of the fact that his days on earth are numbered, so you'll notice little by little an act of disengagement on his part from all his concerns, from all his interests, even with regard to the next of kin, with regard to his children, in whom simply before when he was healthy, he simply gloried and rejoiced, and whom he saw himself reflected. A gradual extinction of interest in others. And this does not come with the gradual, so to say, disintegration of his mental capabilities. No. I saw people, for instance, suffering from cancer, who still were mentally very alert, intellectually brilliant. Brilliant, intellectually. And still, and I know an aunt of mine was brilliant still. And she had her only daughter, and actually she sacrificed her life for her daughter. But when she began to feel that she's doomed, so she lost interest in her daughter. And I saw it, as a rabbi, I see it quite often. Somehow, it's for a simple reason, that man is taken out of this environment completely. He retreats into himself, and then when he retreats into himself, so he becomes a solitary individual. There's no communication. And possibly, for instance, we cannot pass on our feelings. As a matter of fact, can we pass on our feelings to our children, how much we love them? Does a child know how much his father and mother love him? He certainly doesn't know. He certainly doesn't know. Because it's incommunicable. Of course, he can judge our love for him by our actions. That we suffer on account of him, we try to give him an education, we do everything, to promote his career, to build his future. Yes, but there is no experiencing. He cannot experience our love for him. This is an inner secret of the present. His husband and wife get together so closely? Yes, even the most ideal marriage. But husband is a solitary figure and wife is a solitary figure. And yet, there is not complete coalescence. It's ridiculous to speak of complete coalescence. And let, for instance, the husband take sick or the wife take sick. It doesn't matter. And let the husband and the other mate find out that the sickness is fatal. Of course, the first reaction will be that of hysteria. Of course, hysteria. Hysteria, despair. Despair, crying and losing interest in the whole world. As if she or he cannot exist without her or his partner. Yes, but this is just an illusion. It's just a surface experience. Little by little, the individual begins to get used to the idea that you have to reorganize his life, to reorientate himself. And it's like when he begins to think, although stealthily, he doesn't want to admit it to himself, stealthily, he begins to think in terms of rearrangement. How and when the wife or the husband will die, what I wouldn't say he or she thinks of marriage, I wouldn't say that. And although I'm not so sure about it. I'm not even sure about that. I'm not indicting anybody. I'm not sure about anything. But rearranging. And I'll tell you, I don't like to speak about that. I experienced as a father. I'll tell you about my own experience. I told you I had a father to whom I was very devoted. He's to me something which is more than an ordinary father. Anyway, it's a different problem. But my father took sick. He took sick and he died very quickly. Well, he was sick for a couple of weeks. And he died from certain problems, some malignant disease. I don't know what it was. So when the doctor told me, so of course my first reaction was the usual reaction. Complete of numbness, mental numbness. Complete mental paralysis, spiritual paralysis. Hysteria. I don't cry, but it was hysteria. But little by little, gradually, and not knowingly, unconsciously, but unknowingly, I began to see me already without my father. And see my house as if one piece of furniture, a beautiful piece of furniture, a centerpiece, of course,
taken out. And like a woman, a hostess is very capable, she wants to send out a certain centerpiece, who begin to think beforehand how to rearrange the room. I began to rearrange my life without my father, while my father was alive. Let's not fool ourselves. What does it show? It shows only there is no complete coalescence of two individuals. There is no complete merger. There is no complete communication. Even the highest level of love and friendship and sympathy and understanding. Why is it? What have I said? Outside existences merge. Within existences cannot merge. Man, father is lonely, man is lonely. And the moment as long as life flows with normal channels, so I don't think about my within existence. So I can't concentrate on the outside. On the outside, I feel that I'm one with my father. But the moment, I mean, life has played this trick, I mean, there was a twist to life. So I retreat from my outside existence. And of course, from my communication, from my bonds with this vow. Then I began to think, am I actually bound up with my father? Is the bond inseparable? And you too may well answer the problem, the question that in the negative way, it isn't insoluble. You are you, thou art thou, the father is he. And between he and thou, there is a gulf unbridgeable, and the gulf is that of loneliness, of uniqueness. That means this coalescence can be terminated, your outside existence will be hurt, yes? Your outside existence, your surface existence will be hurt, your inner existence will not be affected. And if there is a within existence, you know, the very core, then the outside existence will readapt itself to the within centeredness. And this is exactly what happened. I carry on without my father, and I saw husbands and wives whose father wouldn't be able to exist in a single day. And we carry on. Well, let us now, gentlemen, if you'll just give me a few more minutes, if you want to. You see, in the Bible, if you read in the Bible, the English Bible, now, how was man created? Whatever, how was man created? Alone or in company? They all up in chapter 1, verse 26. 27, yeah, Genesis, 27. Will you be so kind and give me this Bible? 27, chapter 1, verse 27. No, it is chapter 1. Verse 27. Yes, just a moment. I can't find it. 27, huh? It's 27? No. Second? No, okay. What is? And God created man. It is verse 27 here. And God created man in his own image. The image of God, in the image of God, created him. Male and female created he them. Please listen carefully. He created man, and man was created as a female and a male. This is chapter 1, all right? Now take chapter 2. Chapter 2. No, it's again, it's in chapter 2, yes, in verse 18, chapter 2, verse 18. And the Lord God said, it is not good that a man should be alone. I will make him a help meet for him. Yes? And out of the ground, finally, and the Lord God caused a deep sleep to fall upon man, and he slept, and he took one of his ribs and closed up the place of his flesh instead thereof. And the rib which the Lord God has taken from man, he made a woman, and brought her unto the man. And the man said, this is my bone, bone of my bones, and flesh of my flesh, she shall be called a woman, because she was taken out of man. Therefore shall a man leave his father and his mother, and shall cleave unto his wife, and shall be one flesh. Of course, Bible critics already ask the question. There is a contradiction between these two chapters. In the first chapter, there is a story that God created man alone, but male and female, correct? Male and female. In the second chapter is, God said that it's no good for man to be alone. He created Eve out of the ribs of Adam. And you know what the Bible says, it says, that's what to account But usually bioethics make a wrong mistake many a time when they have problems. They don't try to solve the problems at a philosophical level. They already have a ready-made answer, a stereotype answer. Two accounts, two sources. I mean, it's not easy to say. But basically what the Bible describes here, two definitions of man. Men alone and men in company. Adam was created twice. Adam alone, when Adam in the company with Eve. You see, in the morning on that Friday, on that mysterious Friday, God created Adam, male and female, but there was no communication between male and female. Male was alone, female was alone. No communication. It's lonely man, because he was created in the image of God. In the second account, there is no mention of the image of God. Man was created in the image of God. Man was alone. They say the Yotzer Adam Levado, I mean, it's not good for man to be alone, it means only for Adam alone. It's not good for each to be alone either. There was no communication. In the second chapter, is the story how man steps out, tries to step out of his loneliness, of his solitude, of his seclusion, and join the woman. The woman is the first gesture of communication, the first one, and join Eve. It's two stories of man. Both stories are correct. They are not mutually exclusive. Just a moment. They are not mutually exclusive. Basically, there are two types of men in Judaism. If I may use one expression. There is one man that I would call by the Greek name charismatic. Charisma means the message. A man who passes on messages to others. Charismatic man. This is a man who can communicate himself. And there is another man who is called, I would say also a theological expression of it, a luminous man, mysterious man. Man who cannot communicate with others. Man who remains alone, for himself, in himself, self-contained. He's always in repose. He cannot stretch forward. He's always engaged in a movement of recoil. All is for himself. He cannot express. And these two men are in every one of us. In Noah, there is charismatic man, a man who shares his experiences, a man who wants to tell and to relate and to pass on messages and to rejoice with others and to have others share his sorrows and his joys and his glories and his defeats. I mean, as my mother says, for Aristotle, a man is a social being. But by saying man is a social being, it's not said everything about man. Man is also a lonely being. Man who doesn't want to share anything, but he doesn't want to be. I cannot share. Can I share with you my understanding of Judaism? I can tell you. Yes, I tell you. But it's not a question of knowledge. It's the appreciation and feeling and experience. I experience more than I can simply express in words. Basically, I'm not so, my facility for words is very limited in general. I have trouble in writing out a sentence and expressing myself. I always have, I mean, what you call it in Hebrew, Chelme Yitzirah, I mean, the suffering of creation. Of creation, I don't know, I mean, particularly formulating thoughts, and I'm never sure that I formulate them well. So I try to repeat, and the more I repeat, the less I'm understandable I am. Of course, you know, but this is charismatic Adam. He was created the same Friday in the afternoon. They tell you that you're sort of a body. From a practical standpoint, men should look for appreciation, for a social life, for communication, for sharing, for togetherness. Yes, yes, and God created the woman out of his ribs, but not out of his heart. If the woman had been created out of his heart, there would be a perfect marital union. But this can't be. The heart is individual. It's the outside existence, the rib. Nothing else. Nothing else. There are Siamese twins. Siamese twins can have two hearts, two beating hearts. Two personalities. But there is a bond, a physical bond. I would say it's more than a physical. It's a mental bond. But it is what I say, a charismatic bond. A bond by passing on messages. By the dialogue. Eve and Adam carry out a dialogue. They are both charismatic beings. And of course, I understand that Adam courted Eve. I mean, otherwise she wouldn't have married. So probably told her that he loved her. This is, he tried to communicate his love to Eve. Yeah. But did he not? He didn't have said. Like any boy cannot, if he's sincere in his love, cannot communicate exactly what he feels to the girl. It is just a dialogue existence, a charismatic existence. The outside surfaces,
The surface existence merged the inner existence of luminous men who got played. Men and women, you were also played at that time, symbolically. But men remained simply alone. Alone. At a moment of crisis, this bond, which was created between Adam and Eve, the perfect mastermind, born via the dialogue, via the communication, via the revelation, pure somehow, is eliminated. And man remains alone as he was on Friday morning, luminous man, meant for himself.
And I remember, it was 3 years ago, my daughter birthed a child, her first child. And usually woman is very proud of her first child, because it's the real possession she possesses. This possessive instinct in women expressed itself in her relationship to the first child. So I walked in after the birth, the circumcision to her room, to congratulate her. So she was holding the baby, Roger, pressing him against her bosom, and saying, "You are old, you are my own."
And I told her, "It's a mistake. He is not your own. Of course you realize it 15, 16, 20 years from now. Because men cannot join the dial completely. Because Adam was created twice at two levels. At the numerous level of loneliness and the charismatic level of togetherness. If one is foolhardy and is naive enough to think that everything is his, the friends are his, parents are his, children are his, everything is his, of course he lives a life of Adam, the charismatic Adam, Friday afternoon, then Eve, then he met Eve, and he thought that he established a marital union, an inseparable union. But he forgot about the permanent crisis, about the permanent distress. He will wake up, he will find himself that he's not only charismatic Adam with the company of Eve, but Eve is gone and he's alone. And you should be always remembered. All right, up to here, we'll develop that up.
A month ago, Amir, could you, Amir, may I ask you what I said last time, or shall I leave you? Because we have to continue.
You can ask, but it's unfair.
Oh, I'm in the classroom teacher. Yes, correct. The uniqueness of man expresses itself not in his intellect, but in his being for himself. We may call it loneliness, being for himself, what means in existence, in inner existence. He spoke about two forms of existence. First of all, the surface existence, where existence is expressed, say, in action, or if we may use a scientific formula in terms of mass and energy, an existence which cannot be expressed or manifested in action, but it is somehow, it is hidden within. A man cannot be equated with what he is doing. Okay. I mean, did we discuss that?
Yeah.
What's important is, at the conclusion of the lecture, I mean, you were already, I mean, bored and I was a bit tired. I introduced the story of creation. Yes, I am a rabbi. I must go back to the Bible. I mean, this is my book of knowledge. Story of creation, and I've pointed out to you the time, if you have the biblical text. How does it work?
Yes.
If you should take a look, the story of creation, Genesis 1, verse 26-27. Genesis 1, verse 26-27. Just to be a short review, but it's very important. Because in order to understand the social institutions in Judaism, we must understand this dialectical philosophy. Genesis 1, verse 26-27. And God said, "Let us make man in our image, after our likeness and let them have the meaning of the fish. It's interesting. He begins, let us make men. I mean, please pay attention to this. Men, in singular, correct? Yes. Then, there is a change. And let them have dominion. This is correct translation of the Hebraic text. We hear do. Let them have. I mean, you see, he begins to speak about men. Of course, he should have spoken of him in the singular form. Right away, there is a change, grammatical change. And here's the plural. And let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the fowl of the air, and over the cattle, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creepeth upon the earth. And God created man in his image, in his own image, in the image of God created him, male and female created he them. So it means two people were created. So we can understand that Adam in Hebrew is a noun, but a collective noun sometimes. I mean, Adam is not always a person, I mean, it's a single person. It's always, I mean, it may represent humanity or mankind, okay? Because there is no plural to Adam. Adam is not plural in Hebrew. It means collective noun. It means let us create man, and God created two, female and male, correct? Now if we should, thank you very much. If we should turn the page, just a moment, and... Genesis 2, verse 18. And the Lord God said, it is not good that man should be alone. I will make him a help meet for him. And then verse 21, correct, 21. And the Lord God caused a deep sleep to fall upon the man, and he slept. And he took one of his ribs and closed up the place of his flesh instead thereof. And the Lord God had taken, and the rib which the Lord God had taken from the man, made a woman, and brought her unto the man. And the man said, this is now bone of my bones, flesh of my flesh, she shall be called woman, because she was taken out of man. Therefore shall a man leave his father and his mother, and shall cleave unto his wife, and they shall be one flesh. Of course, you know, Bible critics already pointed out the discrepancy between these two accounts. In the first account, we read that God originally created female and male. And the second account, I mean, we find that originally only man was created. The female was created, the woman was created out of the body of the male. I mean, you know what the Bible critics said. I mean, the Bible critics always, when they had any difficulty in the Bible, they always said the one who copied the Bible had two sources, two accounts. The accounts were not commensurate. So he incorporated both into the text of the Bible. This is an extended answer. Basically, Professor Kasuta of Rome, who lectured later in Jerusalem at the Hebrew University, pointed out that many times the Bible critics simply substituted text criticism for philosophical ideas. You see, sometimes there is no contradiction in the Bible at all. It's all a question of two philosophical ideas. By the philosophy, in our instance, by the philosophy of man. For instance, they say the account in the Bible, the first account speaks only of Elohim, of God, what the Greeks used to call chaos. And the second account, it's Lord God, the Shemelekim, Kyrion chaos, and the Greek. And again, it's two accounts. I mean, Sokasuta points out, the two accounts actually, it's one account, but expressing two different ideas. With regard to the creation of man, and I'm telling you that not because I'm an Orthodox rabbi and I believe in the integrity of the text. I mean, this is true, but I'm not prompted by religious motive in interpreting the Bible this way. I mean, don't indict me for that. I mean, it's not fundamentalism which makes me interpret the Bible, but simply I like to understand the Bible. There are two stories in the Bible. One story tells us that man was created, man and female, male and female. The second was that the female was created out of the river, the bone, the flesh of man. Basically, what the two stories want to convey to us is that first man and female were created, but the man did not meet the female, the woman, and the woman did not meet the man. They were in isolation. Each one was for himself. So it means What difference does it make whether one man was created, or woman was created as well? Not a question of priority. It's a problem that men, male and female, well know. There was no meeting between them. They didn't need it. And the institution, we call it marriage, whatever it is, did not come into existence. There was no fellowship. There was no companionship between men and women. Two lonely creatures roamed over the face of the earth. Not meeting each other, there was no cooperative, no cooperation, no meeting, each one such to approach his problem his own way, in his own singular way. And God said, we tell Yosha Adam Levado, it's not good for men to be alone. And it means that men, the story of creation of Eve means only one thing, that suddenly Eve, whatever her name was, the woman who was a stranger to men, became a part of him. So in order to express it in symbolic in metaphors, it is that man fell asleep and the woman suddenly was created out of his rib. It means a union, a miraculous union came about of man and woman. As we say, man leaves his father and mother and cleaves his wife. Exactly what it is. Man was created both alone and together with the Tao. As a matter of fact, woman is not important. Important is the I and thou. There was an I and thou before, but they were lonely. There was neither I nor thou, as you want to say. They didn't find each other. They didn't see each other. They were not aware of each other's existence. Two people can live, even in the same room, or on the same street, and still not being, being ignorant of each other's existence. Later, this coalescence, this union, or this this fellowship came into existence, the fellowship between men and women, because according to the Judaic philosophy, men and women, this is the first, the most basic form of friendship and fellowship, takes place between men and women. That's exactly what it is. That's what I said, I believe, last time. Now let us see. Judaism has introduced a dialectical moment into the individual community relationship. Last time I told you there are two basic theories. One theory gives priority to the community. Another theory, says the individual takes precedence over the community. The Age of Enlightenment, like Rousseau, thought that individual can nicely get alone without meeting anybody else. That's why we call this philosophy, call this theory, the Robinson Crusoe theory, because if Robinson Crusoe could exist on an island somewhere in the South Sea, so anybody could exist on an island. Anybody could create an island for himself, even in New York, or in Philadelphia, or in Boston. It's not important. Anybody could become a Robinson Crusoe. Many of us are like him. We exist like that. On the other hand, we'll take Hegel, and particularly the philosophy which finally was crystallized into the political theory of the corporate state and totalitarian state or totalitarian society. It's not important how you call it. This Iran said, no, man is a servant of the community. You cannot imagine man only as a member of a group. One among the many. We said Judaism disagrees with either theory. It did not accept the individualistic theory, nor did it accept the theory of the collectivistic theory. That there is a supra-individual entity, unity, within which man can find his place, but the individual is completely absorbed. Judaism has introduced a dialect because, if Judaism had subscribed to the individualistic philosophy, there would be only one account in the Bible. That man was created alone. That's all. The first account would be the final one. Had Judaism subscribed accepted the collectivistic philosophy of man, giving priority to the community, then another account, but only one, the second account, would be the most decisive one. Man and the woman were created and met. It means originally, within the scheme of creation, God planned for man not a lone existence, but an existence, so to say, expressed and manifested in togetherness. Since the Bible has two accounts, and I don't care, even if you want to accept, the account of the Bible critics. But there are two accounts. In our Bible, there are two accounts. I don't care about the sources, It's not important. It's irrelevant. The literary construction of it. of the text. But since the Bible has two accounts, of Adam and Eve alone, and a second account of Adam and Eve together, then it's not just something arbitrary in the form of a contract social, as Rousseau wondered. Eve was brought, and the Lord God brought Eve to man, the woman to man. It means it was intended to within the original scheme of creation, to within the original plan of creation. So it means that Judaism subscribes neither to the individualistic theory nor to the collectivist. Because if it did, one account, well, what would be sufficient? So what is the Judaic approach to man and community? Who is, so to say, the master? Man, the individual, or the community? I must say, Judaic approach to community is a dialectical approach. It means it accepts a thesis and an antithesis. A statement and its reverse, the contradiction. And it's a dialectical approach. Judaism has introduced a dialectical moment into the individual-community relationship. At the beginning, man was created alone, man and woman. Yet later, in the process of creation, God let Eve emerge beside him as a companion in order to alleviate the pain of a solitary existence. She was created out of his flesh and bone, and they both were united in one existential community. There is both existence, means loneliness, on the one hand, on the other hand, existence means community, in fellowship, in friendship, in companionship. You ask me, I mean, both theses are mutually exclusive. I told you at my introduction, Judaism has operated many times. These two theses, which are mutually exclusive, and still accepted both. These two very logic by Aristotle, that if there is a contradiction, it means either the first thesis or the second thesis is untrue, was not accepted by Judaism. In other words, man is created both alone and together with others. He did not ask this, so to say, he did not ask for this dialectical experience. It was not done because men chose Eve, or on the contrary, he preferred a lone existence. God did not consult men, and this is exactly why man was asleep. What's the idea of men falling asleep? I mean, we have to understand the Bible a bit differently than we are used to. Why was he asleep? It means it was done without consulting him. It isn't like Rousseau said there was a contract social. Men suddenly realized his only existence is bad. I have to ask for a mate. I have to ask the Lord God. He should provide me with a mate. First of all, God is not the marriage broker. I mean, if Adam had consulted him, he would have apparently referred him to some other marriage broker, or to any club of a lonely heart. But he didn't want it. It means he was asleep. It means it was not in consultation with Adam. Adam, absolutely. It was intended to within the original scheme of creation. This was planned within the infinite will and infinite wisdom of God. That men be born. Men human existence should imply a contradiction, a conflict within itself. On the one hand, man wants to be alone. On the other hand, there is a craving in man to be together with someone else. As a matter of fact, if we should analyze our own experiences, we'll find two basic tendencies. Actually, many times we want to be alone, we are tired of men, we are tired of people, we want to escape into wilderness, simply become a hermit. Anyway, I can speak of myself as a rabbi, I would like to leave my community, everything, my students. On the other hand, sometimes we feel very lonely. We like to be together with someone else. Fellowship is an experience which is basic in our, with regard to our existence. At this juncture, we cross a strange dichotomy. Judaism has rejected the theory about the primacy of the community by telling us that Adam was introduced into the world before Eve, or Eve before Adam.
It doesn't matter, but alone. On the other hand, we cannot subscribe to the individualistic philosophy either, because God brought woman to the man. What does this paradox suggest to us? Simply a dialectical philosophy after the relationship between the individual and society. There is a basic antinomy within one's existential experience. On the one hand, he is unique and different. He was created as one individual, free from all commitments to others, solitary and aloof. On the other hand, he experiences the need for communal existence, for fellowship and friendship. He is unhappy with the role of a lonely figure. He craves for joining the Tao and for commitments, for taking on commitments and responsibilities. Of course, if there's a responsibility commitment, it means to the outside, to the Tao. He wants to share his existence with others, be united with them, be one with the Tao. Man is involved in a crisis. Basically, existence is an experience of crisis for one reason, because loneliness and togetherness of him determine actually the human existential experience. They are mutually exclusive, and yet they are basic and fundamental in our, so to say, in the unfolding of the personality. Man oscillates between a solitary Adam and a communicative Adam. An Adam who wants to confide in Eve. And on the other hand, we have an Adam who is completely isolated. Completely separated from anybody else. He is in the grip of both, of a movement of recoil into himself, retreat into his own shell, into his own selfhood, retreat into a strange selfhood, and also, he is also engaged in a movement of surging forward, advancing toward the outside. It's like a pendulum swinging between two poles. Swings toward the Tao, but when it comes too close to the Tao, it begins to retreat, the pendulum, toward the other pole. The pole of loneliness and an existence for himself, solitude. Existence means a continuous attempting. I'll show you pretty soon, with examples that Judaism knew of it. It's a continuous act of giving to others on the part of the I. It's continuous abandoning of oneself to the Tao, of tearing down barriers which separate an individual personality from the other self. It is the venture, existence expresses itself in the venture of taking in the Tao into one's private world, which perhaps only understandable to him alone. This is on the one hand. And at the same time, existence expresses itself in continuous withdrawal into the hidden recesses of an uncommunicable I. As I have emphasized in my previous lecture, that's why, to Judaism, for instance, the sacrament of marriage appeared to be nonsensical. Catholics spoke of the sacrament of marriage. The union of marriage is inseparable. Judaism, if something is simple in Judaism, it is to divorce the wife or the husband. Simple procedure. Basically, Judaism considers marriage simply as a contractual arrangement. Of course, contract is sacred in Judaism. A civil contract is sacred. That's why many times when I read about the discussion in Israel about religious marriage and civil marriage, I simply do not understand, this controversy. Because basically, Judaism looks upon marriage as a civil arrangement. But the contract itself, even a sales contract,
with regard to Jewish law, is a sacred institution. I mean, marriage is sacred because any contract is sacred. But it's nothing else but a contract. And of course, any contract, any contractual arrangement cannot be sacramental, cannot be an eternal arrangement. Can be broken up, or the contract can be forfeited. And now, that's why the divorce was introduced into Judaism as a basic institution. Why was it? Because Judaism says that any union between Adam and Eve can never attain perfection. Because there's only one Adam who entered the marriage, the marriage arrangement. Which Adam? The Adam who appeared on the face of the earth Friday late afternoon, and to whom Eve was brought as wife. But the Adam who was created Friday morning, alone, he never committed himself to Eve. You see, marriage is involved in this dialectical arrangement. If Adam swings to our togetherness, then marriage is valid. But if Adam changes, I mean, his course, and begins to retreat, and engages into the movement of recoil toward the pole of loneliness, then marriage is not valid. And if Adam had never been consulted, there was only one Adam. We always see two persons. I mean, Adam, solitary Adam, and communicative Adam. And any agreement, any contract signed by Adam is valid as long as Adam takes up his station within, so to say, around or close to the pole of togetherness. But he can't stay there for a long time. He begins to swing toward loneliness. And if Adam is lonely, no agreement can bind him. Because whatever he is for himself, he cannot commit to Eve. Whatever Eve is for herself, she cannot commit to Adam. So that's all our contract, all our social contract, all our commitments, all our responsibilities are relative, not absolute. There's only one commitment which is absolute in Judaism. And you understand this. It's the commitment on the part of men toward God. Because there, lonely man is committed to God. As I said it last time. Lonely. God communicates with lonely men. That's why the union between Adam and Eve can never attain perfection. Because they remain strangers to each other. And I said, I believe last time I said it, of course, it was at the conclusion of the lecture, that basically men can be judged by two criteria. By his inner experience, by his inner selfhood, and by his actions. And his actions I called the kerygma. It is the message he delivers to others. And I spoke about numinous Adam, the mysterious Adam, who is not involved in any commitment and any responsibility for himself, isolated, separated from the crowd. He's self-centered, I don't mean this sense in this derogatory sense, self-centered and self-rooted. He cannot commit himself. And then there is charismatic Adam, who passes on a message to others. After all, the bond between Eve and Adam is based on a message. Adam says something to Eve. Eve responds, answers Adam. It's an exchange of words. It's the dialogue. What binds us together? Basically the speech, the dialogue, the conversation. I mean, how much can I express in a conversation? In a conversation I can express just one part, an infinitesimal part of my experience. This was the attitude of Judaic attitude toward society. How much can I express to you? Just an infinitesimal part of my experience. First of all, my vocabulary is perhaps limited. Secondly, there are certain experiences which don't lend themselves to externalization, objectification. Because always when you take an experience and you try to relate it to others, to tell others about the experience, so the experience right away becomes depersonalized. Because you already try to explain to others how you feel. If you explain to others how you feel, you have to employ categories and metaphors. I mean, symbols of language which teach your very passionate, your very intimate experience, which is part and parcel of your inner core, and you try to objectify it, depersonalize it, universalize it, generalize it. It should be understandable and comprehensible to everybody. That's all I mean. And I always say, marriage begins with a declaration of love. Of course, I mean, love is an inner experience. But when the declaration is passed on, the message is delivered to Eve, then love becomes depersonalized. Himself, and I'll tell you, if you'll see many people, they have a facility for language, a facility for expressing themselves. Of course, kerygmaticism somehow is, kerygmaticism has, so to say, is manifested by far in a more pronounced manner than numinacism, the mysteriousism. Some people are reticent, self-centered, all right, we call it extroverts and introverts. But, you see, if we begin to operate with psychological categories, we sometimes overlook the problem, basically. Basically, it's not types. Judaism did not believe in types. There are introverts and extroverts. We are both extroverts and introverts. But introversion is not just a habit in the part of man, or just a dent in his character. It's a metaphysical experience. I exist here, within. I cannot relate myself to others. It's a certain rebellion, revolt against authority of society, against authority of any institutionalized, in religion, against state. It's rebellion within the human being. I am for myself, no one can understand me, because I have no language how to explain. Can you see my heart? The old expression, the man sees the eyes, God looks into the heart. What does it mean? Man sees only appearances. God sees the within existence. This is we call it introversion. It's not introversion. It's an existential experience. On the other hand, this is numinous man. Numen means mysterious. Mysterious man. He's a numen to himself. On the other hand, there is charismatic man. Man active. Man endowed with speech. Man capable of expressing, portraying himself, writing books. I mean, pouring out his thoughts, his feelings into a book. I mean, printing, a confession, I mean, about his life, writing an autobiography, I mean, telling people about the most intimate phases of his life. This is charismatic man. This is Adam, who was Adam and Eve, Friday, late afternoon, that mysterious Friday, about which the Bible speaks. That's why Judaism never said, no human institution has absolute or ultimate worth, significance. Because in any institution, peoplehood, family, community, state, only charismatic Adam is involved. Numinous, mysterious Adam for himself stays away from all those entanglements. It's a complete policy, if I may use the dramatic language of the United States, of isolationism. Man basically is both an isolationist and also a very cooperative being, extremely cooperative. And Judaism did not, so to say, condemn either numinous Adam nor charismatic Adam. They said, both are welcome. It's a dialectical experience. And upon this foundation, the Judaic social ethic is based. Otherwise, we cannot understand. Well, I'll give you examples later on. In the forthcoming lectures, certain laws with regard to tzedakah, charity, family, we cannot understand unless we take into consideration this basic conflict within the human personality between the kerygma, giving the message to others, and the numen, the mystery which cannot be disclosed to others, but it remains mine forever. They understand, I would say then, only charismatic Adam committed itself to Eve. Numinous Adam never joined Eve. Numinous Eve did not join Adam either. They understand only isolated experiences translated into the universal language which objectifies the intimate and depersonalizes the personal. And they understand each other in equivalence for a mysterious experience. They understand each other basically not as persons, but as things and events. Basically, the Tao to me is not a person. It's an event.
I mean, in spite of my efforts to understand the Tao and to feel with him and to have compassion with him and to have sympathy and share his troubles and his joys, he's less than a person to me. Of course, you know, after the Rahat Amecha, you should love thy neighbor as thyself. It's a very nice ideal. It can never be implemented. Never. We'll interpret this idea later. It can never be implemented. And Judaism is a very realistic religion. It construed ideals, yes, but Judaism was always conscious. I mean, aware of the fact that there is not only an order of ideals, there is an order of facts, events, and things, what we call an order of facticity, not only of ethical norms. And there is never complete commensurability between the two orders. And basically, when we look at the Tao, it is an event, it's a thing, yes, an object, never a subject. In the sense of individual personality, not even with regard to my father or to my mother. I like my mother, I love her, but to say that I feel just that I have an insight into her individual experience would be ridiculous. And the same is true on the part of childhood. On the part of a child with regard to his parents, and perhaps, of course, this is already the greatest commitment. I always believe that with regard to parental love, somehow is rooted in the newness of Adam, just a little bit. I don't know. But, however, I saw even parents who lost children and they survived. There is never complete forgetting. They never forget a child, but they survived. Apparently that even the parent can go on and continue without a child. So all human commitments, responsibilities, unions, fellowships, are just relative. There is no absolute commitment in this world. Of course, there are people who feel a stronger sense of commitment. There are people whose commitments are shallow, superficial, because they are emotionally superficial. They are shallow emotionally. There are people who are intellectually deep, profound, and intellectually shallow, I mean, we also find people who are emotionally shallow. Their emotions are just surface emotions. And some people have deep-rooted emotions, yeah, but again, only relative. The eye remains isolated, aloof. It is a noble gesture on the part of the individual, certainly noble, to give, to open up, to share, to form fellowships. It is perhaps the main law in our system of ethics. Social ethics in Judaism says, give, step out of your isolation, come forward. Forget about your luminous character. Stretch out your hand. Shake hands with the Tao. Don't live in an ivory tower, sheltered, against community, against others, against the outside. Share everything you have with others. Yes, we say. But the Jewish ethics knows very well that this norm will never be implemented. It will be an attempt on the part of the individual to come forward, to share, to sympathize, and to have compassion, and to love, and to help. But there will never be complete coalescence, complete merger, complete union, complete fellowship. He and she, or he and he, doesn't matter, will remain two individuals, lonely figures, solitary existences, which will never get acquainted. Never. I don't believe that even man and husband and wife, who live for 40 years, and I say, the perfect marriage, and love each other, respect each other, and raise the family, actually share each other's troubles completely, and I would say in absolute sense. There is a partition separating. There is a partition. I always say, if I should picture ourselves as a desk with many drawers. So of course, when we marry, so we try to map the drawers to each other, you see. But there is a drawer, whether the upper drawer or the lower drawer, both in the husband's desk and the wife's desk, which remains locked and closed. There is something which can never be said, expressed, told, passed on, externalized, luminescent. The goal of giving will never be achieved. The unique personality is unable to communicate itself to the Tao, and as such remains mute and inapproachable, what theologians call I mean, not with regard to personality, with regard to that numinous, mysterious. Eve is also as lonely as Adam, and Adam is Eve. They never find each other. Charismatic Adam and charismatic Eve do not succeed. Human institutions are a failure. In long analysis, human institutions must fail. What does the institution want? What does every institution, any institution, to bring Adam and Eve together? I mean, of course, they are symbolic of the eye and the heart. They are never, they are brought together, yes, yes. But no, bosom ipsori, flesh of my flesh, bone of my bone. It's a beautiful dictum, but it's not reality. It's not reality. Friendship, community, marriage, any association are never perfect because only charismatic Adam and Eve are involved. Now, Judaism at this juncture points out a basic conflict within our existence, the incommensurability of two orders, that of uniqueness and togetherness, of seclusion and community. Man lives in two dimensions, in the numinous and the charismatic, for himself and with others. He is both visible and invisible to others. In other words, there is something man which does lend itself to communication, to externalization, and man is capable of expressing, I mean, his experience in form of a message conceivable to others. And then man is to be looked at as a story. Actually, when we want to know man, how do you know him? We read his autobiography. So man is a story. Man is a story, and as such, is a very exciting story. It's a very exciting story. It's a romance. A story of any man is a romance, full of adventures. And there is in man something aboriginal. This on the one hand, man is a story. On the other hand, there is something in man aboriginal. And wholly other, that cannot be subjected to universalization and categorialization, and as such, remains outside of the kerygma realm, of the message realm, and beyond the reach of the objectifying hand. This something in man is inexpressible and esoteric, not to be communicated as a story to others, since there is no objective coherence and causal continuity in it, and it remains a numinous experience of oneself, in sight of which the eye stands speechless, humble and amazed, and asks the eternal question. Man asks himself, who am I? Because charismatic Adam cannot ask this question, who am I? Who am I? There is a mathematical equation. I equal the amount of work and energy and which I have contributed toward the welfare of others. That's all. Simple equation. Who am I? When we ask, who was Napoleon? Who was Napoleon? Napoleon equal. There's an equation, mathematical equation. Some total of the wars, and certain social reforms, and so forth. All right, a good equation, a bad equation, doesn't matter. Who was Theodore Roosevelt? Who was Franklin? F.D. Roosevelt? Well, it was actually, I mean, the New Deal reforms introduced in the United States, the creation of welfare state, and so forth. Ah, yeah. This is charismatic Adam. But numinous Adam, numinous Roosevelt, numinous Napoleon, will ask himself, who am I? I mean, you cannot say that introduce such an equation that man equals, I mean, his actions, his deed. Only charismatic Adam equals. He's identical with his action. Who am I? And basically, we begin to think who we are, we never find an answer, do we? I don't know who I am. This is the I who retreats into seclusion whenever man is exposed to the process of standardization, or whenever one's life is being turned into a story. To be told, or a charisma to be delivered to others. It is the question, who am I, is the eternal mystery, which is beyond understanding and rationalization, unfamiliar and extraordinary. Now, I'm sorry I called
I wanted Robert Feldman to call me, but I couldn't, because he thought I was in New York, and in Boston, I was in New York. There's a beautiful story written by the Yiddish writer Peretz. I must say, there was a writer who understood me intuitively. He was not a scholar, far. Judaic philosophy, it was Peretz. Intuitive, of course, he makes mistakes. But he had the intuition of a genius to apprehend and comprehend basic Judaic ideas. And there is a short story which is called The Catalyst. It is published in English, both by Maurice Samuel, I believe, and also an old translation by Elena Frank. It is Philadelphia Jewish Publication Society of America, 1906. A story. So there in the story, he portrays a conversation between two Kabbalists, between the master and the disciple. Between the master, I would recommend to you to read this story. There are many more like that. Between the master and the disciple. And the master says, tell the disciple, therein, said the teacher, are many degrees of attainment. One knows a bit of a tune, a melody, another half a one, another a whole. There is one kind of a tune that must have words. That is a low order of tune, not sublime tune. But there is a higher kind, a tune that sings itself, but without words, a pure melody. But that melody must have a voice. And lips, though to which the voice issues, are material, are tangible. And lips, you see, are material things. And the voice itself is refined matter, certainly, but matter nonetheless. Let us say the voice stands midway between the spiritual and the material. However that may be, the tune that finds expression through a voice and is dependent on lips is not pure. Not entirely pure. Not yet really spiritual. The real tune sings itself without a voice. It sings itself within one, in the heart, in the thought. There you have the meaning of the words of King David. All my bones shall say, how great thou art, my God. It ought to sing in the marrow of the bones, in the marrow of the bones. That is where the tune should be. That is the highest praise we can give to God. That is no human tune that has been thought out. It is a fragment of the melody to which God created the world. It's the melody of the soul. He breathes into man. Thus sings the heavenly family. Thus sang the Rebbe, the master, whose memory be blessed. He speaks about different kinds of tunes. Of course, the tune expressed in words is man's story, man's character. The composer, basically, will take Beethoven. All right, there are beautiful compositions. Whatever he expressed in a symphony, it was just his charisma. He had a tune within himself. Beethoven himself could never externalize himself. It's only part. It's perhaps only a reflection of the inner tune, of the inner melody, of the soul, of the heart, of the marrow, of the bones, as Peretz says. And this is true not only of a genius like Beethoven or Goethe or Kant or Michelangelo. It is true of everybody, of everyone. There is a tune we sing, this, our story, our actions, our deeds, our lives, visible to others, understandable by others. People appreciate, people condemn us, people praise us. Yes, I mean, this is charismatic man, man in society, man in community, man within his family, man at his home. This is the tune sometimes in words, sometimes without words, but he said a voice is certainly necessary. And a voice is something material. I mean, for the Kabbalist, it was between spiritual and material things. But we know from physics very well that the voice is as material as my own bones and flesh. I mean, it's a wave, airwaves. The voice is also material. But there is something immaterial. It's not a question of being immaterial. Something subjective, intimate, personal, not detachable from the personality. This does not lend itself to anything. I can feel the tune. I can feel the melody. And the melody is my own existence. This is the melody of the existential experience. But how can I sing it out? How can I write it out on a sheet
in letters of music? I can't. This is numerous Adam, who was created Friday morning. And it's very interesting that the epithet Bitzelen Elohim, the image of God, is only mentioned with regard to numinous Adam. He's not mentioned with regard to Adam who found Eve. If Adam found Eve, he doesn't have need for God. Many company does not crave for God because the company compensates him. It's a substitute for God, basically. But numinous Adam, who feels alone, lonely, deserted, abandoned, he looks for companionship. He can't find the companionship in this world of things and events, in this world of kerygma and story and melody sung out, I mean, in words and voices, in loud voices, in this still world of his, in his within world. And whom does he find in his within world? Not Eve, nor does he find Adam in her within world, but God. Returning to the axiological social problem. Of course, this is metaphysics. This is a part of the Jewish metaphysical, the personality. But we are not so much interested in metaphysics as in its practical application in our daily life. What does this numinous Adam mean if in terms of social action, social welfare, and our dealings in terms of our interrelationships with people? Returning to the axiological social property, we must unequivocally state that Judaism insisted that the genuine worth of the individual personality expresses itself not in the quality of the kerygma, I wanted to suggest it, but since I spoke about numinous Adam, I couldn't express it. We must unequivocally state that Judaism insisted that the genuine worth of the individual personality expresses itself not in the quality of the kerygma. This is important. He is capable of delivering to the Tao, or in the beauty of the story. Or in the beauty of the story he tells to others. One has a beautiful story, one's life story is a bit boring to others. Not so adventurous, I mean. No, the individual worth does not consist in the beauty of the story, or in his accomplishments, but in the very fact that he exists. Man has intrinsic dignity because he is. Dignity of man is not attributed by Judaism to charismatic Adam, but to numinous Adam. Because dignity of man goes back to Tzelem Elohim, to the image of God he was created. Charismatic Adam was not created in the image of God, but numinous Adam. Alone, unique, one-timely, irreplaceable, different from others, in a word, in his numinous personality, in the great mystery of an individual existential experience, in the inability to pour out one's thoughts, feelings, doubts, and strivings into narrative to be understood and enjoyed and appreciated by others, availing ourselves of Terence's literary categories, the greatest of men manifests itself not in the song or in a melody spelled out in sound, in a word or sound, but in the silent melody
which intoxicates the heart and raptures the soul, a melody which is audible only to the self and to the great infinite self, but to no one else. Out of the dialectical experience of the eye, Judaism isolated the moment of loneliness and set it up as the criterion by which the worth of a person is to be judged. Whether or not Adam joined Eve, whether or not Eve joined Adam, whether or not he affiliated himself with the Tao, whether or not he put across his social message. Everybody had a social message to deliver, to put across, in terms of contribution to society. And made worthwhile contribution, all this is irrelevant as to the inner worth of the personality. Since Judaism is concerned with man for the time being, with man for himself, not man within the framework of the community. Our Talmudic scholar said, it's a famous dictum, why was man created alone? Lama nivra adam yichidi. In contradistinction to all other living creatures whose emergence took place within a group or a class system. If you'll be so kind, we'll just take the Bible. And you'll take, for instance, Genesis 1, verse 21. And God, Genesis 1, verse 21. And God created the great sea monsters and every living creature that creepeth, wherewith the water swarmed, after its kind. What does it mean, after its kind? Liminary, what it means? Within a class and group system. And then, for instance, you'll take verse 24, and God said, let the earth bring forth the living creature after its kind, cattle and creeping thing, and beast of the earth after its kind. Again, not one steer was created, not one lion, not one worm, not one snake, but system, class, species, within a species and class system. As far as man is concerned, just two lonely individuals were created, Adam and Eve, who did not know each other. Why did the Creator, in making man, depart from the general pattern of creation? Why didn't he create mankind? Why only one man, mankind? The answer our sages gave to the question has revolutionized social philosophy in the antiquity and upset the classical anthropology, philosophical anthropology, about which I spoke before. Kolam kayim nefesh achat, kilokiyem eila mole. Whoever saves one life is rewarded as if he had saved the whole world. Means man did not appear on the face of earth within a class system because his worth would be measured by his contribution toward the welfare of the class. He was created alone because his world for himself, a microcosm, a small world, a microcosm. And this dictum, Adam Olam Katan, man is a small world, the Olam Adam Gadol, and the world is a great man, a big man, is a truism in medieval philosophy, Jewish medieval philosophy. Yes, someone raised his hand. Yes?
But man was created in our image.
In God's image.
Which in itself is a time.
No. You mean later to be passed on. But it cannot be. Basically, you cannot speak, again, you cannot speak of mankind. Because what does a kind mean, a class? Philosophically, a class means something. What do you mean? How do you say it? You speak this individual table? Let us take a very logical problem. In classical logic, this individual table, and you speak the table in general, at large. How do you arrive at a table at this universal, what do you call universal? By abstracting from the individual traits of the table and retaining only the universal, so to say, adjectives or traits. So, for instance, this table is, for instance, half round. So, I mean, this is not important for the table. For the table, you probably see it has some support and a board above. You see, there are universal traits in things and our individual traits. You create a class, how do you form a class? By abstracting. When you say the bear, the wolf, by abstracting from color, from abstracting from height,
abstracting from specific individual traits of a particular animal, but assembling, so to say, the universal traits and forming a class. I mean, this is known, this has been known since Socrates. So now you see mankind. You abstract from whom do you abstract? From numinous Adam you abstract, because numinous Adam is the individual, different Adam, unique Adam. Whom do you take into mankind? Only charismatic Adam. Adam's story you take in. Actually, man as individual does not belong to mankind. He doesn't belong to mankind at all. He is not a member of mankind, because he has no commitment. And his essence, the core of his existence, expresses itself in otherness, in being different, in not being gleichgeschaltet, in not being standardized, in not subjecting oneself, I mean, to equalization and standardization and universalization and generalization for myself. So always mankind is also a relative concept. Only charismatic men, but not numinous men. In other words, the word of man, as I said, Kuantai, whoever saves one soul is rewarded as if he had saved the whole world. In other words, the word of man is not derived from his involvement in a system of hypostatized, unitary, supra-individuality, this is community, but flows from his own individual existence. That is why the Halacha has formulated very peculiar laws which reflect the concern of Judaism, not with the crowd, but with the lonely person. Interesting is that Judaism has simply preached a doctrine, perhaps I'm exaggerating a bit, but I have no other way how to express it. Judaism has preached a doctrine of idealization, of anonymity. It means the anonymous person, humble. No one knows it because it didn't accomplish anything. It is the ideal for Judaism. Idealization of anonymity. It's a philosophy of the choiceness, the prira, of the forlorn, desolate, very lonely, despised, and unknown individual. It is somehow, it preached a philosophy. I mean, so to say, it sang praise to the pauper, and I would say to the vagabond. Now let me quote a law. It's a famous law. And this law has been practiced by Jews throughout the centuries. If heathens, it means enemies, heathens, said to a group of Jewish women, a city is under siege, or a house under siege, doesn't matter. And the heathens, of course, it means an enemy. Whenever the Talmud spoke of enemies, it used the substitute, heathen. If heathens said to a group of Jewish women, surrender one of your number to us, that we may defile her, or else we will defile all of you. They should all suffer defilement, rather than surrender to them a single person, regardless of the number of women who are involved in it. 1,000, 10, a million. If someone demands a sacrifice of one individual in order to save the community, and the alternatives are clear-cut, and there are no doubt what will happen if this request will be denied, so the whole crowd of women, most respectable women, should be subjected to. And said to Israelites, surrender one of your number to us, that we may put him to death. Otherwise, we will kill all of you. They should suffer death rather than surrender a single Israelite to them, even if they specified an individual, saying, surrender that particular person, man or woman, to us or else. It is Maimonides' Code, Foundations of Law, 5.5. There is an opinion in the Palestinian Talmud, and this opinion was almost accepted universally, that even though the woman they specified is of lax morals and practices prostitution, this woman, this particular woman, or the man they want is a criminal,
deserving the death penalty anyway. The community must not extradite her or him in order to save the honor or the lives of hundreds or thousands of fearful and law-abiding citizens. If a community is under siege, it must not sacrifice the life or the honor of an individual, notwithstanding the fact that this individual is guilty of the most abhorrent crime, in order to protect the many. Of course, after the siege will be lifted, the community itself, acting in freedom, in accordance with its moral and legal conscience and codes, will bring the transgressor, if he deserves a penalty, to trial and punish him. But if it is a question of exchanging the individual for the crowd, even a prostitute must not be exchanged for a crowd consisting of the most honorable, God-fearing and God-loving women. This is strange law. Yet when the question of I or he or she, the multitude or the single person arises, the community must not take precedence over the most sordid life, which is, in the opinion of charismatic Adam, worthless. What does a prostitute mean? How? Why is it? If we had measured, if Judaism measured accomplishments, charismas, life stories, contributions to society, the law should have been changed. Yes, sir. Who? Someone wants to ask.
There's the protection of the individual by the community. It doesn't indicate how you protect the individual, other than the fact that you don't sacrifice her, you don't give her up.
Yes.
Therefore, what is Jewish thinking relative to Jew participating in war, which means that you protect the individual, but you also do harm to another individual?
War was a problem in Judaism, which gave us a lot of headaches. Basically, Judaism is opposed to war. The only kind of war which Judaism knows and sanctions is a war of defense. Imperialistic wars are completely ruled out by Judaism. The only possible way how to fight a war is in defense of war. And if someone is aggressor, as evil as us. Of course, this is the maxim of Bolle Holger Hashkin Rogge. If one wants to kill you, he has a right to defense. Self-defense is a basic right in Judaism. And war, the legality of war, if it is sanctioned by Judaism, is founded only upon the principle of self-defense. But if one wants to find glory in war, the type of the wars fought by the Greeks, according to the Iliad and the Odyssey, are abhorrent to Judaism. I don't say that many kings, as recorded in the prophets, didn't fight imperialistic war, but this was always disapproved and condemned by the prophets, by Isaiah, Jeremiah, and so forth. Correct, you are right. Jephthah is a sacrifice which our rabbis have disapproved of. When he sacrificed his daughter. Whom else did you mention?
Jonah,
where did he sacrifice himself? He himself? Yeah, this is the duty of the individual. Yeah, I'll come later to it, and I'll discuss the ethical problem. There's an ethical problem. The duty of the individual is to sacrifice himself for the community. Yeah. You see, we'll see how Judaism is a dialectical approach. Judaism will tell the individual, yes, my dear friend, I demand from others to respect you not according to your contribution to society, but according to your inner worth. But however, I demand from you to act not as a numinous person and to say my dignity is assured because I exist, but to make yourself, so to say, worthy of the respect of others in terms of your charisma. So it means others must not sacrifice the individual. The individual is duty-bound to sacrifice himself for the community. Otherwise, you see, to speak about numinous Eden, glorifying him, and putting him on the pedestal, it would mean that men would become selfish, egocentric. There is a danger. There's an element of risk. You see, others should treat the individual according to his inner worth. I must treat myself not according to my intrinsic worth,
This means inactivity, this means selfishness, this means egocentricity, this means the individual will consider himself as the center of the world, everything revolves around him. I mean, you know what it may lead to, I mean. I must say, I am nothing. As Abraham said, I am just dust and ashes. Because I'm a servant of the community. It's a dialectical approach. That's why I call it dialectical approach. It's a strange approach, but it is a dialectical approach. So all these sacrifices you find in the Bible. You see, the trouble with Jephthah was that he didn't sacrifice himself, he sacrificed his daughter. This was the trouble. If he did it, if he sacrificed himself, we would glorify him now. He would be considered a hero. Abraham, I expect this problem. This question. I'll beg you to suffer with me for a while. I'll come to the story of that later. It's premature yesterday. It's a good question. It's a good problem. But you'll tolerate my ignorance.
I think you alluded this principle was in the European religions of not giving up some individuals, because it appears that the whole communities operated during the last war on the principle that we will give up part of the community to the Nazi quotas because the rest of the community will be safe. And a recent article in commentary which talks about two ghetto dictators.
I mean the head of the communities, probably.
The two were Moses Marin of Sosnovich and Jacob Gans of Vilna, where they were operating on the principle of they would select a certain number of Jews. They were doing the Nazi dirty work for them and ship them off.
I know.
And the community seemed to go along with the principle that promoted that we will give up part of the community in order to save
through the whole community. I'll tell you. As a matter of fact, Gans I knew personally. It is the story of Castor, you know, the trial of Castor in Tel Aviv. Of course, it is in contravention of the basic Jewish law. That the communities approved of it is no proof that this was done in conformity with our ethical conscience. On the other hand, I'll tell you frankly, when this judge, Levy, condemned Castor, I said it was a mistake, because I don't know how I would have acted if I had been in the ghetto. In general, we have no right to condemn them, nor to approve of their deed. We cannot approve because it's contrary to the basic Jewish ethic. However, to condemn them, we are human beings as well, afflicted with the same frailties and weaknesses, and I don't know whether I wouldn't have acted, like Kastner, trying to save my family and a few of my friends, and for this, and safe to say, to retain, my beloved ones, perhaps I would have sacrificed, the rest of the community. But it certainly was not done in conformity with the Jewish law, and I don't believe there was a communal consent.
No.
People were helpless, people were frightened. In general, in such a situation, it's hard to expect people to act intelligently many times, and particularly consistently. They were frightened, they were many people told me their experiences. Their intellect was paralyzed. They were guided by instinct. And of course, if guided by instinct, like the animal in the field, then the ethical norm plays no role. The ethical norm is important when man is guided by the intellect. But it's guided by the instinct. It's the instinct for the impulse for survival, and that's all. But I would never say that actually rabbinical authorities, responsible authorities, we have black sheep, we have responsible authorities have approved of such a policy. Such a policy is even a million Jews in one individual. The individual cannot be sacrificed for the million Jews. Whether it is practically wise, I don't know, gentlemen. Our religion was realistic, but never wise. Never wise.
Wasn't it also kind of consistent regard for the person with the outstanding...
Correct. It's a good question. For the scholar, you mean. For the scholar, particularly.
During the last war, the organization was to help the same intellectual, the outstanding person, rather than...
Yes, I'll tell you, of course, for scholars, we Jews have respected the intellect. But, again, these societies acted... there were societies, to save scholars, many scholars were well-saved, as a matter of fact. Yeah. This business of giving preference to the scholar, however great, in Jewish law and Jewish knowledge, over the simpleton is non-Jewish. We did it. Perhaps I myself was involved in that. But to say that I acted in conformity with Jewish law, because any shoemaker in Vilna, or any woodchopper in Vilna,